Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Dermot Sugrue. How are you, Dermot?
I'm very good, very good. Good to talk to you again, Chris.
Yeah, it's been, what, 5 years, I think, since we last spoke?
I think it is.
Number two, and I'm at recording, I'm up to show 251. So.
Wow, okay, so only I've missed out a cool 250.
Yeah,
but it's great to be back. Great to be back.
You've left Knightimber. I think last time we spoke, you were at Knightimber, and now we've even spoken to Cheryl, the lady who's now in charge of the winemaking there. But you've moved off to Wisden.
Yep, Wisden Estate.
And after doing a few stints in India, is that right?
The chronology of it is, I left Knightimber in August 2006, did a vintage in Champagne Jacquinot and Moët & Chandon in Champagne in say September and October 2006, and then when I returned, I took over the management of the newly planted Wisden Estate vineyards, which had been planted in early 2006. Originally, Wisden had been planted with the intention of supplying Knightimber, enhancing the production of Knightimber with grapes grown on chalk soils.
Yeah.
This was the intention of taking the Wisden Estate vineyard on board. However, things changed when I left Knightimber, and
he's had a lot of acreage. So
that's right. The philosophy of Knightimber changed quite dramatically with Eric's new regime taking over. I liaised with Harry and Pip Goring of Wisden Estate, and that's the project which has now matured into a winery established in 2008, and the first wines in 2008. And quite a range of exciting wines which we're going to be able to release over the next few years, and importantly, to finance the whole project and to provide what I think is quite a necessary service to the nascent sparkling wine industry, the establishment of a contract winemaking facility for lots of small producers.
Is there many people providing that service? I know of one winery that uses another company to do their contract winemaking, but contract winemaking, people don't talk about it a lot. We spoke earlier about one of the wines I just tasted recently, and Mike Roberts had made it. So Mike Roberts at Ridgeview is doing contract winemaking for some people.
Yeah.
But who else is doing it? Is it a mature part of the market?
Well, it's not really. If you consider the infrastructure of the UK winemaking scene, I suppose we are a small industry, still a young industry, but it's not as developed contract winemaking as, say, for instance, it is in New Zealand, where, you know, contract winemaking is a huge part of the industry, or at least has been over the last 20 years, you know. You've got lots of instances of vineyards who either decide for either financial or quality reasons that they don't want to get involved in establishing a winery. They concentrate on fruit, and they get their wine made by established winemakers who have got wineries and who have got a reputation, let's say, for quality, and they go down that route. It's a very, very necessary thing and a useful thing, and especially when you consider sparkling wine production, because the investment, the capital expenditure in establishing a winery, a sparkling wine winery, in the UK, is really, really intensive, you know. So if you're going to plant a vineyard, establish a winery, and sell your wine, that's a big, big, big portfolio of almost concurrent businesses to run. If you choose to just establish your vineyard and sell your wine and contract out the winemaking to somebody else who you can trust and have confidence in, then that can be a much more viable proposition.
You've just established a winery in the last couple of years. What sort of costs are involved in setting one of these puppies up?
They're big puppies. They're big puppies, which can be very unpredictable.
Are you talking puppies or Rottweilers here?
yeah, exactly. It's very, very difficult to generalize. One of the key things that we were able to do at Wisden is utilize an existing building, an old building. It was a building used as a food processing plant in the 1970s and 80s, and then was redundant for some period of time. And once I actually explored it and and looked at it, I realized that it was perfectly suitable for conversion into a sparkling wine winery, because A, it's huge, B, it's very, very cool, and therefore easy to insulate and regulate temperature in there. And it was compartmentalized to serve the different functions that are involved in the different phases of sparkling winemaking, so it was perfect. Now, if you're to build a building like that from scratch, there's huge cost involved, okay? Because of the size of it, all the planning requirements of it, and, you know, we see this with wineries trying to start off today in the UK. You know, great plans, there's even money there, but getting the planning to actually do it is a different thing. So to start off with effectively a brownfield site ripe for redevelopment that was already owned by the financial partners involved in the Whitston estate, where Harry and Pip, was a tremendous advantage. Okay, we've spent a large amount of money, somewhere between £1 and £2 million so far. That includes the initial planting of the vineyard, the management of the vineyard until it produces its first fruit, the establishment of the winery, the processing, everybody's salaries, rah, 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 rah. It adds up to that so far.
What sort of equipment do you need? You need a press?
Okay. You want to talk about, you know, say, the basic building blocks of establishing a winery?
Yeah,
I mean, the first thing you need is an appropriate building with floors strong enough to be able to take the weight of your tanks filled with juice, filled with wine, filled with sugar as well before it ferments into alcohol. It's much, much heavier. A good drainage so you can get the waste stuff out. You don't want that hanging around. Yeah, place to put that waste stuff in the right place so you remain popular with your local environmental people. And press, stainless steel tanks. Barrels, a combination of both, you know. When you're talking about a still wine winery, that can often be enough. You add on top of that your cold stabilization process, your bottling lines, your storage facility, labeling, whoosh, bottles out. With sparkling wine, it's quite different because at the time of bottling, you then need to lay all those bottles down. Bottles are very, very often stored for 1, 2, 3, 4 years for sparkling wine production. So you need a massive amount of space to be able to hold concurrent vintages all at the same time. Then you need riddling equipment, so remuage, giro pellet, or do it by hand, which is not so common these days. Then you need your...
What do you use at Whitston?
We use giro pellet. Yeah, yeah. We can just...
I call it gyro pellet, but...
giro, it's maybe a French... French inflection, yeah, from my Irish roots. yeah, but you know, you need that kind of space for giro pellet. You need to be able to, you know, then your disgorging process. Then you need stock or space to stock your wines post disgorging, which are, you know, then you need your bottling and your boxing and your wine out. So you're talking about an awful lot more space is required for a sparkling winery than for a still winery. Those bottles are hanging around for a heck of a long more time.
I said, there's quite a big kit there, isn't it? You know, and it's a space as well. I hadn't really thought about drainage, though.
Mm.
I know wineries get through a lot of water, so I presume you need a pretty good water supply as well.
Yeah, you do. You do indeed. This is one of the reasons why with the building we chose, it was a former food processing plant. It is a massive, big 50-mil feed directly coming in from the motorway.
Do you know what I've got on my house? Domestic supply?
13 mil?
32.
32? That's pretty good.
I tell you what.
Are you a bit of a serious gardener?
No. But I had to put a new water supply in, and it was the same price for 15 mil or 32 mil.
So you went for 32. Good choice.
Yeah,
good choice.
Yeah. I got three floors. I got great pressure and no pump.
Very good. Got a high-quality shower.
Exactly.
Good. Yeah, I know. You need a hell of a lot of water. Okay, it's not as bad as, you know, I've heard the statistics of making wine in Australia, how much water is required to make a litre of wine, and it's frightening. We're nowhere
near
that. Yeah,
it's like 100 litres. It's bonkers.
We're nowhere near that in the UK, you know, and there's water falls plentifully throughout the growing season and beyond. There's a lot of groundwater typically about. Maybe it's changing. It certainly has showed some signs of changing over the last few years. But yeah, you use a lot of water.
Who employs your services as a contract grower? You know, do they have to use Dermot Sugu to make the wine, or can you provide just facilities, or...
Yeah, no, the way we operate is I make the wine for everybody, okay? I'm not interested. You can have a situation where in a contract winery, the client, the vineyard, buys its tanks and supplies them and puts them in there. I'm not really terribly interested in that kind of situation. I like it to be more... more straight down the line arrangement. Vineyards are looking for somebody to make their wine for them and to give their expression of their vineyard an expression, basically. In many respects, I'm in a quite a lucky situation where I can choose the people who I'd like to make the wine for, because I'm not really interested in making a huge amount of wine for a vineyard that's not really situated in a very good place, that doesn't produce good quality grapes, that doesn't have a conscientious vineyard philosophy to it in terms of, you know, the how they take care of the vineyard and the wines they aspire to make. So I can afford to be a little bit choosy in that regard, and it actually makes it very nice because it ensures that I'm making a portfolio of wines every year that are high quality wines, and that they're fun to make, and it's the owners of the vineyards are very pleasant people to actually interact with, because when you don't have those things, suddenly winemaking doesn't become as interesting and energetic or energizing, rather, as it should be, or at least for me, it should be.
Yeah, no, you start moving into more industrial production, don't you?
Precisely.
Okay, and what percentage of the winery is used by Wisden and versus, say, contract growing?
Typically, it's about 20% of the production of Wisden Estate Winery is for our own home vineyards for Wisden
Estate.
That's
very low, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
You've got a big facility.
Yeah, I've got a big facility. Last year, I made 20 different individual sparkling wines. I made four sparkling wines for Wisden Estate. So I made a Brut sans année, made a non-vintage wine. Made a cuvée, made a blanc de blanc, and made a rosé, all for Wisden Estate last year. So that's four wines. I made another 16 individual sparkling wines for different clients, for Jenkin Place, for Meppham, for East Meon Vineyard, for English Oak Vineyard, for Stopham Vineyard. I'm sure I'm going to forget a few, but I made quite a few wines.
If you're making wines for one of your contract suppliers, do you go to the vineyard and help them assist when to pick and all that sort of stuff? And what happens if all the grapes turn up at the same time? Do you have scheduling issues?
There are always scheduling issues. For instance, even in 2010 last year, I knew right before the start of vintage it was just going to be crazy. No matter how well we tried to manage everything, it was going to be crazy. You know, you've got botrytis invading some vineyards. You've got people trying to pick early to avoid that. It's always going to be bonkers, and the potential then of rain changing around, scuppering the schedules. But I try to work, and I want to work with the vineyard clients as much as possible. You know, there are limits to what I can do, and maybe limits for what they'd want me to do in terms of the involvement they have in their vineyard. But certainly towards the latter end of the season, the business end of the season, the ripening end of the season, I'll visit each vineyard periodically to assess and take samples to look at how the grapes are maturing, and then to be able to try and estimate when is the best time to pick for logistical purposes, but also, you know, to achieve the desired wine style that those clients are after, and what I think is probably best for that vineyard. You know, just my own view, my own feeling about how we can do something interesting and more interesting year on year once I get to work with the vineyard a little bit more. So yeah, I like to be involved as much as possible with the grapes as well as the winemaking.
You talked about testing. Do Wisden have a good lab?
No, I actually contract almost all of it out to a very, very good new laboratory. I say new; it's been around for 2-3 years, and that's Custom Crush. It's run by Emma Rice in West Sussex, and Emma can do analysis of grapes pre-harvest, as well as the whole range of winemaking analysis, typical winemaking analysis. So it's a little bit too much at the start. I used to do it, but I'd end up driving all around Kent, Hampshire, and places like this, coming home at midnight and then spending until 4 o'clock in the morning pressing, doing sampling of grapes. And I thought, it's too much. Just before harvest, it's a little bit too much.
Yeah.
So I tend to contract it out to Emma.
Okay. And what sort of tests would you normally expect to do?
Most indicative ones at that time of year, say in the month prior to picking the grapes, is a measure of the sugar. So you're looking at Brix or grams per litre of sugar.
You can do that in the field though, can't you?
Oh, you can do. You can do that with a refractometry, yeah. But it's always best to actually take samples back to, you know, pick 100 berries or something like this, a random sampling in the vineyard, take them back to the lab and press your small amount of juice and then look at the potential alcohol. So, you know, Brix or grams per liter, but the PA, because the PA, the potential alcohol. So in terms of the amount of sugar that's there, if it was fermented tomorrow, it would give you how much? Oh, it's at 8.5% alcohol, 9.5, it's 10.5% alcohol, etc. So
do you look at acidity at all, though?
Yeah. So you're looking at the potential alcohol. The titratable acidity or the total acidity, so there's a combination of the tartaric and the malic and the other acids that are there, the pH of the juice, and also sometimes you can look at maybe the malic, but it's better maybe to look at that more towards the end of the ripening cycle. So what you want to do is you want to plot a curve of increasing potential alcohol, the sugar maturity level of the grapes, decreasing total acidity, and indeed it's going to be an increasing pH as the grapes are losing acidity and building up their sugars. And then over that, and that's why it's important to start maybe 4 weeks before what you think will be the anticipated picking date, so you can plot the curve, and then you can see actually when it's leveling out, and you're feeling about when the about how the weather is changing or not changing, and whether it's getting to the point where actually it's too risky, there's bad weather coming in. Because in England, one thing we know for sure is that always towards the end of our harvest, middle of October, last week of October, closing in on November, that's when the bad weather is coming. Suddenly gets cold, suddenly gets wet and dark. And if you're still struggling to pick up some ripeness at that stage, and there's disease threat and things like this, you've got to make some decisions whether to get it in or else you can compromise part of your harvest.
Yeah, obviously this is commercially sensitive, so I don't need the exact numbers. But so how is contract winemaking priced up? How does it work?
Without giving away too many commercial sensitivities, the important thing from our point of view is that we give a proposition to the client that offers them value for money. Okay, it allows us to justify the expense we've spared on or expense we've paid to establish the winery and to continue it going and to expand it every year, and to make a profit, because of course we're in this industry to try and make some money in the long run. In the long run, I stress. But value for money and affordability for the client is absolutely key, because if we don't offer that, then somebody else is very welcome to establish a contract winemaking facility and offer them better value for money. So it must be affordable within the overall scope of the client's total cost of production. They've had to plant a vineyard. They manage the vineyard each year. There's a cost of producing fruit. Then they contract out the winemaking to us. That's a fixed cost. And that can be very, very useful for them. They produce 10 tons, 20 tons, 50 tons, 100 tons and send to us. They know there will be a fixed price over the next few years that they can incorporate into their overall financial planning. And then when it comes to selling their grapes, there is a their wine, there is a cost to marketing and selling the wines, and of course they know what revenue they can potentially get from that. So what we charge our clients needs to fit in very rationally with that overall cost of production for the clients. If it's bad value for money, they won't go for it. Yeah, it's good value for money.
It's not exactly answering the thing. No, you should be a politician, mate.
Well, I can tell you. I mean, roughly, you're talking about to contract out a sparkling wine to ourselves, it's going to be somewhere in the region of £5 a bottle, plus or minus.
Does that include disgorgement and all that?
Yeah, that includes everything, and that includes
bottles.
You could say somewhere between £5 and £6 per bottle, including a period of on lease of between 12 and 24 months.
Oh, okay.
So you're talking about that type of price, and that includes all of the winemaking, all of the rental of the facilities while the grapes are being processed, juice into wine, etc. All of the material costs of production, which is the bottles, bidules, capsules, the lees aging in a temperature-controlled cellar, the remuage, the riddling, the disgorging, which involves a cork, a wire hood, period of aging post disgorging, etc. And then there would be more if you're talking about packaging, labeling, putting on a neck foil on top of that. It's an additional cost, but you're basically in that ballpark of £5 to £6. It differs on scale. If client A is bringing 50 tons a year or in 1 year, and client B is bringing 5 tons, there's going to be scale differences
for sure.
But yeah, hopefully I've answered your question a little bit more.
Yeah, that's a bit better. That's more closer to the park. Okay, now that sounds excellent. I think we'll wrap it up there, Dermot. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Chris.